Thai man denies drugging a model and leaving her for dead.
Hong Kong woman duped into sex to reincarnate her dead mom.
Kill 10 people and go to jail? Not in the Philippines, where you might end up running the jail.
In our interview with the director of the first movie hitting screens about last year's dramatic Tam Luang cave rescue. Welcome to the Coconuts Podcast, our look at the latest and greatest reporting from our 8 newsrooms in Southeast Asia and Hong Kong. I'm Todd Varis, and I'm the managing editor of Coconuts Bangkok.
And I'm associate editor Tara Kamaltanavith. Hello, hello, hello.
Hi.
Another day, another podcast.
Yo, yo, what's going on?
So much is going on.
Oh, it's exhausting, isn't it?
Right. We got a few very dark stories. One in Bangkok that we covered this week that's been gaining virality amongst the tabloid news.
Well, yes, and we make fun of the tabloid news because so much of it is awful.
Right.
And there's a particular obsession with dead women, hot women, and this week we have a kind of both, I suppose.
Double whammy of virality.
So, some dark crime stories, some usual, what's going on in Hong Kong?
Some more Hong Kong eruption. What is happening?
We've got some more of the same in Hong Kong.
Same, same, but different.
We've got a big food fight in Indonesia.
Yeah, that's a fun one.
And we got Tom Waller in the studio. He's the director of Nang Non, The Cave, which is going to be the first film that is going to hit the screens. It's an adaptation of last year's dramatic Thai cave rescue.
I'm sure a lot of our listeners tuned in last year when 12 boys and their coach in the Wild Boar soccer team got trapped in a cave up in Chiang Rai.
You're so American. That's football for those of you listening at home.
I know. I used to say football until I lived there. Guys,
I grew up saying soccer, but I've adapted.
So these footballers, soccer players got stuck in the cave.
Either way, they were stuck in that cave.
Right, and the whole world watched while these rescuers, these brave rescuers, dive into water that was described as coffee dark, a thick latte.
You're making me thirsty.
Right, and rescued the boys, and all of them survived. Miraculously.
Yeah, it was quite an event. And I mean, I think everyone followed that, and a lot of people may have felt oversaturated on it too, so there may be some people wondering, like, hey, why do we need a film about it? So stick around, and we asked just that of the director. So
right, and the really cool thing about this movie, which we're going to talk about, is that a lot of real people are going to be in this movie. He got a lot of the rescuers, a lot of reporters, including Coconuts Bangkok's own Todd Ruiz is going to be in the film. So it's super exciting.
Well, stick around. We'll come back to that in a minute. Let's hit the news.
Let's do it.
In the wake of a prison scandal that saw some of the Philippines' worst rapists and murderers set free for good behavior, President Rodrigo Duterte has named a new man to head the correction system. Did Duterte tap a respected civil servant or seasoned bureaucrat for the job? Sure, if by that you mean a man accused of 10 counts of murder after a grenade killed as many inmates at the prison he oversaw 2 years ago, Gerald Bantag blames negligence, and at least one count of fraud for firing his gun inside a restaurant where he'd allegedly skipped out on the bill. Totally normal stuff here. Oh, and he shot a kid 3 times back in 2007.
Sounds like a regular guy could find down the street.
Duterte responded to the criticism saying, hey, don't be so quick to judge. After all, the jail fragging case has been downgraded from murder to mere homicide. Innocent until proven guilty, right? Said the man, who's been alternately blamed or celebrated for the extrajudicial killings of thousands. He might get convicted, Duterte said. But in the meantime, I like him because he threw a grenade. Allegedly.
Under a fluorescent glow, a muscular man carries the limp body of a woman into the elevator. He leans her against the wall and presses the lobby button. After fixing his hair, the door opens and he drags her stiff, unresponsive body out. Moments later, as he later told police, he left her in the lobby of his Bangkok condominium. But it's that elevator scene, captured by CCTV, that has convinced so many online that the woman, a popular commercial model, was already dead. The body of Titimat Nolapanpipat was found early Tuesday morning, still in the lobby. Ratched Wong Thabut, a 25-year-old model and fitness trainer, denies any wrongdoing and said he only took her to his room because she was drunk. The mystery of her death has become a tabloid sensation since then. On Thursday, initial examination results found tears in her vagina and traces of semen, which strongly suggests that she was sexually assaulted while unconscious. It doesn't help Ratched that he posted images and videos of the unconscious Titima on social media before and after taking her into his room. He even preemptively denied drugging her in one, saying that she, quote, was naughty on her own. The police said Thursday that they have yet to officially name a suspect, as the investigation is not yet complete. Ratched says they were working at the same private event on Monday, and he was taking her home in his car because she was too drunk. He says he took her into his room because she passed out before telling him where she lived. Titima, who has a large Facebook following,
would have turned 26 Thursday.
Eight commuters were injured Tuesday morning when a Hong Kong subway left the tracks. Though no one was seriously hurt, it was quickly swept into the raging conflict that's been raging between the pro-Beijing and pro-democracy camps for months. A pro-Beijing newspaper ran a front-page story citing zero evidence that black-clothed rioters might have caused the accident by throwing debris onto the tracks. It was headlined, "Bizarre Derailment, Terror Attack on the MTR?"
So it was in the form of a question? Like Jeopardy?
Oh, yeah. That's an old newsroom dodge. See, instead of writing, "Tara is the worst person ever," which would definitely be libelous, I might say, "Is Tara the worst person ever?"
Right, because that's so much better. The question wouldn't bother me at all.
Yeah, well, it'd probably help me get out of a lawsuit. Well, the report cited unverified claims about, quote, "thugs throwing iron bars and debris onto the track, seriously threatening railway safety." On Wednesday, the Mass Transit Railway operator, which has drawn the fury of protesters in recent weeks, confirmed that no evidence was found of anything suspicious on the tracks. It did say they found a number of cracks, which could have been there before or after the accident.
Rendang is life. Rendang is love. Rendang is worth fighting for.
Wait, what is rendang?
You know, that question would be sacrilegious in Indonesia, where it is one of the most beloved spicy red meat dishes. That rendang is everything was proven when two ladies were filmed fighting over the beloved Indonesian dish at a wedding reception. On Tuesday, a video showing the two impeccably dressed Indonesian ladies shoving one another in the buffet line started making rounds on social media. It appeared that, before the video began, one lady had called the other out for taking too many pieces of the coconut curried beef from the rendang tray. "You have no shame! You classless! You want to feed the whole damn village?" the rendang hungry woman tells the other at one point. "I can do whatever I want, whereas you cut in line," the other retorts, before they start throwing sharp elbows at one another while guests try to break them up. I mean, I've never had rendang before, but I can definitely see myself punching some hoe over some thumb if I was really hangry. But I have to be really hangry to get there.
I've seen it, people. It happens. Now back to Hong Kong for a very different story, where a master Thai monk convinced a 24-year-old Hong Kong woman that he could reincarnate the souls of her late mother and aborted fetus. To do so, the 40-year-old first convinced her to rent him a van that he needed to travel around and harvest pieces of their souls. Fair enough. She also bought him an iPhone to store those soul fragments in.
That's convenient. Put it on iCloud.
Next, he said he would need 106,000 Hong Kong dollars, over 13,000 US dollars, which she gave him. Now, he didn't stop there. He next said he needed to make a tree out of Thai banknotes and a golden sculpture of her dead mother. For good measure, she also agreed to give him some of her mother's gold jewelry. If you think this story ends with the woman reunited with her mother and unborn child in their new bodies, you haven't been paying attention. The man, who turned out to be a con artist named Mickey Fung Tin Ho, was sentenced to over 3 years in prison Tuesday after pleading guilty to 19 charges, including 15 counts of theft and 3 counts of committing an unlawful sexual act by false means. That because Fung also convinced the woman that she needed to have sex with him to cleanse her body for the supposed ritual. She agreed, and they had sex 3 times, including orally and anally. After police arrested him, Fung said he'd warned the woman to keep everything a secret or the ritual wouldn't work. Oh, and he'd already spent all of her money. It turned out he had a criminal history stretching back 20 years, including theft, fraud, and unlawful sex with underage girls.
Thai authorities have now called in cave rescue divers from the international community to help with efforts to locate the children.
How many of you?
13.
16 months after the rescue of the Wild Boars football team captured the world's attention, the first film to recreate those dramatic events is headed to the screen. The Cave, or Nang Non, relies heavily on direct accounts from behind-the-scenes participants to present some of its untold stories. With us in the studio today is Tom Waller, the film's Irish-Thai writer and director. Tom, welcome to the Coconuts Podcast.
Thanks for having me in the studio.
So the teaser just dropped. Tell us what the reaction has been. And I ask this
mindful of the fact that there's some people who, no matter what the film is, are going to say, look at these people rushing to cash in on this. And I, that stuff's out there. It's the internet, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, you can't edit the internet. It's just, you know, it's impossible. Once something's out there, it's difficult. So I think for me, the reaction has been mostly positive. I was absolutely flattered to see the amount of views. You know, we got like 1 million views within the first day on one of the YouTube sites, on the major Cineplex YouTube site. Just went crazy with comments. And I could spend all day reading comments about the teaser. Although that won't be doing me any good because a lot of them...
reading comments is not...
As you tell me every day.
This is a newsroom axiom. Don't read the comments.
I mean, you have to sort of develop a thick skin as a filmmaker. So it's not the first time that I've had to read comments about my own work. Now, the teaser trailer is just the teaser. It's just to give you an idea of the mood and tone of the film and what you're likely to expect.
Right.
A lot of the storylines in the film are not in the teaser.
It did have. I mean, I was happy to see, you know, the moment that really kicked things off. And, you know, up until that one moment where
John Belanton says, how many of you? 13.
Exactly. Yeah. That's it. And that's what flipped the switch on this story from a curiosity in a distant land. Right. And you sort of assume the worst. And in newsrooms, we think, they're dead. Right.
Right.
I thought that all week. And then suddenly, wow.
Right.
Miraculous. Yeah, it was an amazing moment. And I remember watching it on television and thinking, it's incredible that we have this footage, that that they had a GoPro camera in there.
Yeah.
And, you know, what we did in the film was instead of, you know, try to copy that or to make it, because that's already iconic. You can watch it on YouTube. We didn't try to in any way better that. What we did was to give you maybe the other perspective, you know, to see from the point of view of like, you know, well, what are those kids seeing when those lights come in? You know, what are those kids going to do when they hear these
thinking that. I remember thinking these kids are sitting in this cave in this dark and then suddenly,
right.
What, there's some lights coming
appear, yeah.
And these creatures emerge. I mean, they could have thought a lot of things.
Right, foreigners, like all of a sudden pop up.
I mean, they come up, you know, they're like aliens arriving because they come up with the lights and everything. So for me, it was very interesting to be able to recreate that scene and find a different way of giving you the same... You know, it's the same dialogue. You hear the guy saying, you know, how many of you? 13. But basically, it's different. In the film, you'll get that iconic moment from a different perspective. So, in fact, we watch a lot of those YouTube trailer reaction videos. You know, the other night I was watching one, and some of them are hilarious because they play the teaser and they kind of put their own kind of, you know, commentary on it.
Right.
And for a lot of people, when those words come on, that flips the switch for the viewer.
Totally.
And I see this kind of wry smile on a lot of their faces. Because I think a lot of them, you know, they're used to watching maybe Hollywood, big A-list movies with $200 million budgets. And, you know, Thai films are usually quite small with limited budgets. This one, we had quite a lot of, I had a lot of, you know, production value with this film. We spent a long time making it, and we filmed it over, you know, weeks and months, if you like, because we had to go back and reshoot things. So it's not a flimsy production that you'd think was put together quickly. It was put together quickly, but we've been very thorough in telling the story.
Well, you shot how many weeks or days?
Well, I'll talk about it in shooting days. So usually a film can vary from anything from, you know, 18 to 55 days shooting. Yeah. We shot about 35 days, but we also shot a lot of what I call pickups and second unit days that maybe weren't counting as a proper day, as in we went up to shoot in Chiang Rai.
That's where the cave is located.
We tried to make sure that we had enough coverage in the right season as well, because of course the color of the grass changes, you know, so we had to go up and shoot the rice fields, you know, quite soon after the event so that they didn't turn yellow.
So it's not a lot of green screen, fake cave?
No, I mean, there's hardly any digital work in the film. It's all done, you know, very realistically. We shot multi-camera. We have a very.
What was that like shooting? I doubt any of your previous films have taken you underwater.
The underwater segments, I think, are the most challenging because you're dealing with safety. You're dealing with kids in the water. You're dealing with, you know, actors, and you're dealing also with the mechanics and the engineering of being able to put a camera underwater and being able to view that image and to see whether it's okay. So yeah, it's very difficult to make a film underwater. You know, we were filming in real caves, so we had to worry about, you know, creepy crawlies and snakes and spiders that bite and all kinds of nasty things. So, and I remember this one time we had a snake wrangler go in there first to kind of extract a snake that was seen in there.
Oh, nice. And he kind of came like up a with normal...
this wriggling snake. And I was like, well, you know, is that poisonous? He's like, it's not poisonous, but it can bite.
It could bite.
It could bite.
Was that, I mean, is this like Thai movie product? Because, I mean, half of our stories are about snakes popping up in weird places. Is that a normal Thai movie? You got to send in the snake guy to make sure it's clear?
Oh, yeah.
There's a snake budget, just to clear
snake
them.
Wrangler, yeah.
And audiences should expect to see more of those familiar scenes in the film.
A lot of the iconic scenes in the film are taken from, you know, news footage that we've recreated the scenes, you know, in the film. We have very, very, very few shots from the real thing. It's all been recreated as a movie. And that's why it is a fictionalized account of what happened.
So I got to ask, you know, I mean, a lot of people want to do this film. I mean, it was a huge story. Everyone knows this. I don't have to even explain much about this, because I think at this point, the world knows exactly what we're talking about.
Right.
Sure.
It's been a year, and they remember so many things that happened in this, from the highs and the lows.
Entire world was watching. The kids were on Ellen. It's like an international sensation by now.
So my question is, a lot of people, I'm sure, want to make films about this, want to adapt this, in part because it's a great story, in part, some would say, because of a quick buck. Why did you take on this project? Why did you want to tell this story, Tom?
Well, I think like everyone else on the planet, you know, I watched the news and, you know, my heart was beating. Actually, I was in Ireland at the time. As you said before, my father's actually Irish and my mother's Thai. And although I was born in Bangkok, I was also educated abroad. So for me, seeing this story unfold through the mass world media immediately gave me this idea that actually, you know what, maybe I was the right person to make a film about this story. Maybe not the only person to do it, but certainly in a unique position to be able to harness kind of, you know, having had that cultural background of being both Western and Thai. And it happened to be fortuitous that one of the divers involved in the rescue came from Ireland. He actually flew out from County Clare in Ireland to help with the rescue.
Warney, correct?
Yeah, Jim Warney, who's actually Belgian, but he lives in Ireland. So, you know, I went to see Jim, and, you know, we had a very, very interesting cup of tea, as it were. And I ended up staying for a couple of hours, and he just kind of downloaded everything to me in those 2 hours that he spoke. Quite emotional about it, really, because he had been through this whole ordeal.
This was soon after he got back.
This was right after he got back from Thailand. And, you know, he had no connection to Thailand at all. So when I discovered that there was this man involved in the rescue, and he was from the county next to where I'm from, you know, my dad's from Tipperary and he's from County Clare, I just went around and visited him. And we chatted about it for, as I say, a couple of hours. And I was really intrigued by the story that he told me.
I think one of the thing that stood out to me the most in researching your movie is the fact that you have real people in your film, that you actually talked to the people who were at the cave. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. We have a roll call of people involved in the rescue appearing as themselves in the film. I mean, not only do we have, you know, rescue volunteers who dropped everything to go and help, but we have, you know, several people who were part of Jim's team, you know, part of the rescue diving team were also appearing in the film as themselves. We have Mikko Pasi from Finland, who actually he's a dive instructor in Koh Tao. So he appears in the film as himself, playing himself. We have Tan Sao Long, a Chinese cave diving instructor, who also appears as himself in the film. And we have Eric Brown, who is the only North American diver involved in the rescue. So all these guys came on board the project in order to make it authentic, in order to tell Jim's, you know, to tell the story. And it's sort of through Jim's eyes. So we kind of see their interactions with Jim and how Jim met them. You know, this is the authentic story of what happened. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of films, they take liberties with the truth. And of course, yeah, certain scenes have to be dramatized because you have to take some creative license. But at the end of the day, this is a very realistic depiction of what really happened.
So I hear that there are some interesting stories behind Puyai Tan, which is one of the...
Yeah, there were some ties involved. What can you tell us about Puyai Tan? Yeah.
We have an interesting character, Puyai Tan, who's one of the instrumental people in draining the cave of all that water. I mean, he brought in these turbojet pumps to really extract the water in much greater quantities so that they could really remove as much water as they could to let the British cave divers into the what we call Beyond Chamber 3, which is where the forward operating base of the mission was. He drained a lot of that water so that they could go in, so it was safe enough for them to go in. And eventually they found the boys, actually. 10 hours after he drained the water, they discovered the boys in Chamber 9.
That was the moment.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Why did he do this?
He saw those kids on the news. He saw it on TV. And although he's about 1,000 kilometers away from the scene, he basically dropped everything and put his pumps on the truck, whatever he had left in his factory, and he headed there, and he drove through the night to get there. And of course, there's a long story, but cut short, he wasn't allowed in straight away.
When he got there, they're like, who are you?
Yeah, they're like, you need a badge, you need to have a permit, you know, where are you coming? Sure. They just didn't know.
Well, speaking of permits and permission, the government moved to quickly kind of lock down this story. And I think a lot of people appreciated the impulse to sort of protect the children from overexposure. You had to go somewhat outside of that. So how did you tell this story without having that access?
The film people who wanted to try and, you know, tie up the rights or buy their rights or get this exclusivity on their story, you know, they came like vultures. So in a way, it was important for me not to just be another vulture, but I had to just approach this from a completely different perspective and to say, listen, I'm a Thai filmmaker. I've made Thai films. I have somewhat interesting angle on this, which maybe other people are not going to do, because I don't think the characters in my film will be in any other Hollywood. You know, they're not going to be in the Hollywood version. Puyai Tan is not going to be a character in the Hollywood version. For me, to approach the story without kind of permission was the first challenge. You know, what would I get away with? And that was really what was going through my head, was like, well, how far can I take this? You know, when am I going to get shut down? And that was really the thing that went through my mind every day when I got up to go to set, was like, are they going to stop us? You know, when we tried to go film at the cave, is there someone going to say, you can't come in?
Right. Were you ever able to get into the actual cave and film?
Finally, after we finished principal photography, we actually got a letter from the Ministry of Culture saying that we could go and film at the cave. And this was something that came through like way after we'd finished filming. Yeah. So in a way, we had to remount, go back and start all over again and shoot.
Wow.
Not shoot the whole thing again, but we had to shoot the scenes that were meant to be in front of the cave.
Right? Yeah, okay.
We shot pickups in front of the cave, and we shot all the scenes that we needed, Tam Luang, the real Tam Luang.
Right. Well, I mean, you can't do a Tam Luang film and not have some Tam Luang, so it's good to know that that's in there. And that was complete...
That's exactly what I told them. I said to the Ministry of Culture, I said, listen, that would look pretty silly, wouldn't it, when we're playing at film festivals, and I have to tell them that, we weren't allowed any access to the cave. So,
it's a bit of a disingenuous... It was a bullshit question, because I think I filmed a scene inside the cave with you. Yeah.
That is correct. I wasn't sure whether we were going to own up to the fact that you're in the film,
Todd. Full disclosure, like when we wrote that brief last week about the trailer coming out, but I worded it very carefully. I put a conflict. I said that Todd had filmed scenes for the film.
Well, you're very lucky you're still in the film. Todd,
well, no, I was going to say, I wrote it very carefully that way because I assumed you got some better judgment hit you and you left me on the editing floor.
Well, luckily, your scenes passed with no cuts as well, so you're absolutely still in the film. I mean, one of the nice things about it was that I had this, the raw footage of you giving, for example, your, piece to camera when you were doing your Facebook Live broadcast at the actual site on the night of the night before the rescue, for example. Yeah. Those were real, in terms of my storytelling. I used those as a kind of guide to tell us where we are in the story, and your character in the film also is a kind of a little bit like almost like a Greek chorus. You know, you kind of update us as to where we are because we can't show the whole story. And I think it was important to have the press corps represented in the film because they were a big part of how we saw the story.
Elon Musk is in there, right?
Elon Musk is not in the film at the risk of
getting sued.
Well, it's
you
just
wanted to make some money doing this.
I think the thing for me was, when people started asking me, when they heard about this film being made, the first comment I get was like, who's playing Elon Musk?
I'm sure.
And that kind of put me off because I felt like we don't want to just, use Elon Musk as a reason to go see this film. I mean, yeah, sure, we want bums on seats, but there are other ways to tell a story.
Yeah, he played no part. Yeah. I'm just wondering, because, with the fact that there's so many renditions of the story coming out, like Netflix is doing a series and documentaries and such, how do you feel as a filmmaker being one of them to tell this story and kind of the first to tell a somewhat fictionalized, nonfiction and fiction, but you're kind of the first person to get your story out.
It wasn't easy making this film. I mean, we made this film under a microscope. And, whenever you go to a location, you say, oh, we're making a film about this, about the wild boars, about the Mubah. It's sort of like dollar signs sort of light up in their eyes and they think, oh, you're making a film about that? Oh, you must have lots of money. So it was a constant struggle trying to get sort of people on side to help us. And yet people were also worried about opportunities being taken away. For example, they said, well, if we do it with you, then maybe we can't do it with someone else. So it's almost like, people didn't want to give us all their stories. They're like, oh, we're not sure, how much are you going to pay us for being in the film, because we've got this other better offer. So we found a lot of kind of competition. And of course, what's happened now is that there's been this kind of confusion when we released the teaser trailer. Lots of people who maybe weren't following the making of the film, they just saw the teaser last week and, this is the one being made by John Chu, or this is the one being made by the people who made Crazy Rich Asians.
Yeah, right.
So they've got it all mixed up, which is fine because I don't mind if people think we're like this very expensive film that got made.
Super
but I don't actually think that it's a problem when you go and see the film because I think that people enjoy my version of the film just as they will enjoy the Netflix series or the documentaries or the many other, the books and the novels that are being written about this. There's a lot of material that's going to come out about the Tum Luong story.
Sure.
And maybe not just, right now, but in the years to come.
So you're heading off to the festival circuit soon, I believe, right? You're actually premiering Korea?
That's right. We've been selected for the Busan International Film Festival, which is one of the the most prestigious in Asia. So we're very lucky to have that chance to premiere the film there. And then we'll be following that with a premiere in Vancouver, actually. North American premiere there and a European premiere in London. So we're at the BFI London Festival the second weekend in October. And then audiences in Thailand will be able to see the film in November when it comes out in the cinemas here on the 28th.
Okay, and they'll be the first general audiences really to get their teeth in this thing?
Sure, yeah. We're going to give Thailand the chance to see it first, and then hopefully we'll get distribution around the world.
Our guest Tom Waller's film, The Cave, a.k.a. Nang Non, will be released in Thailand on November 28th. Tom, thanks so much for coming by and talking with us.
Thank you.
No problem.
All right, folks. Well, that's all we've got this week. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thanks for tuning in.
We'll be back next week with more fun stuff. Keep tuned. We'll announce something soon.
Yes.
From Bangkok, this is Todd Rees.
And I'm Tara Kamoltanavith. The Coconuts Podcast is written and produced by Todd Rees and Tara Kamoltanavith. Our executive producers are Byron Perry and Chad Williams.
You can find all these stories and more at coconuts.co.
Or better yet, become a Coco Plus member at coconuts.co/membership. All right,
folks, thanks again.
Thanks for tuning in.